programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Colligan Water of Cache Valley, family-owned and operated for more than 62 years, providing Colligan bottled water, salt delivery, or soft and conditioned water. Hey Colligan Man, service from the man in blue. Online at logan.colliganman.com.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Growing up poor in a devout Mormon home in Logan, Utah was anything but ordinary for Ingrid Ricks. Spending summers on the road with her traveling salesman father, sleeping in trucks and selling merchandise on the side of the highway was an escape from the strict rules of her mother and controlling stepfather. Her mother made her pray more than 7 times a day, a verbally and emotionally abusive, domineering stepfather, 4 siblings, and a father who's never around. That was life, but life was good for Ricks once school was out, spending her teenage summers with her larger-than-life father as his partner in crime on the road, traveling the open roads of the rural Midwest. Hippie Boy is the book. It's a social commentary on religion and status and the story of a small-town girl vying for the attention of her family and along the road finding her independence and happiness as a woman on her own. Ingrid Ricks is also the author of Focus, a memoir about her journey with the blinding eye disease retinitis pigmentosa, and a short story collection, a little book of Mormon and not-so-Mormon stories. She's currently working on a memoir about her year-long quest to heal her eyesight, blogging about that journey at DeterminedToSee.com. She also is a teen mentor, recently co-founded WeAreAbsolutelyNotOkay.org, a program that empowers teens by helping them to write and publish their personal stories. Ingrid Ricks joins us, I believe, from Seattle. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So let's jump into how you came to write this memoir. I think you had it on your mind for quite a while, and I was reading somewhere a couple of seminal events. First was your diagnosis of the eye disease, right?
That's correct. So for years I'd wanted to write this story, but there were a couple of things that kept me. One, I felt that like it wasn't the responsible thing to do. I had a couple of very young daughters to support and, you know, just didn't seem responsible to give up my marketing career to go after my dream. And the other is that it was really emotional for me. One, I didn't want to offend anyone. I love my parents. I didn't want anyone to think that I was being negative against the Mormon church. And also, it was really emotional for me. Every time I would sit down to write it, I would cry. And then a couple of things happened. 10 years ago, almost to the date, I walked into an eye doctor's office for the first time in my life, expecting to walk out with a cute pair of red cat eye frames. And instead, I learned that I was going blind from a rare degenerative eye disease and that I was already legally blind. And that, I mean, shook me to the core, and I had an opportunity shortly after that to go to Africa to write about AIDS orphans. And it put it in perspective for me. It made me recognize that life is short, that none of us, no matter how much money we have, no matter how famous we are, none of us can control whether we will get a disease or whether we will die or lose a loved one. So I realized that I had to go after my dream, and the time was now. And I started taking classes, memoir writing classes. I had started as a journalist, but learning how to write a narrative nonfiction was very different for me. So I started taking classes, but I still couldn't completely give myself permission until Thanksgiving 2009. And at that time, my two daughters, Sydney and Hannah, were 8 and 11, and we were out on a family getaway, and we were walking down the street, and the two of them decided to do a parody of me as an old woman. And they swear they didn't plan this, but they both bent over, pretended like they were walking with a cane, and kind of in the oldest old person voice they could muster, they yelled, my book, I have to finish my book. And they all burst out laughing, my husband and my daughters, and I bit my lip to keep from crying. And the next morning I went and asked my husband if we could go get coffee, and I said, I want to do this. And he just laughed and he said, I thought that would get you. And that's what really made me go after it and give myself permission to do this.
Yeah, that would give you a jolt, wouldn't you?
It mortified me to think that that's what I was putting into the universe, mm-hmm, you know?
Yeah. You sent this out as an ebook.
Yes.
That's how it became a New York Times bestseller, right?
Yeah, and it's been a long road. I self-published it, and truthfully, I started with an agent. I mean, I did everything that I thought I was supposed to do. I finished it in the summer of 2010. I wrote a book proposal. I found an agent shortly afterward, and I celebrated for about 30 seconds until she said, between now and when I take it out, you need to build an author platform. And then she said, and if you could get Oprah and Gail to take you camping, that would be great. You know, so I started building a platform. But after a year, I thought, you know what, I just want to publish this on my own and do this on my own. So in the fall of 2011, I did. And I've, you know, just slowly building momentum and continuing to push it. And last summer, yeah, in June, it landed on the New York Times ebook bestseller list. And then that's how I connected with Berkeley, my publisher now.
And it's now out in paperback.
It is.
The title is Hippie Boy, A Girl's Story. Ingrid Ricks, who is a native of Logan, Utah. So, Ms. Ricks, you're speaking to maybe an audience, some people who would have known you growing up.
Yeah, absolutely.
At any time you write memoir, I guess you do have to have that in the back of your mind. Am I going to offend people?
Absolutely.
Because you're telling... It's definitely from your perspective, but you know there's some bad things going on here, especially regarding your stepfather Earl. So how did you work through that? Make a decision? Well, I'm going to write it. Have to write the unvarnished truth as I see it, and I guess let the chips fall where they may.
So the thing about it is, you know, Hippie Boy is my story about growing up with difficult circumstances and finally finding my voice and power. But I didn't actually really find it until I gave myself permission to write this story. And it wasn't, so right after I got diagnosed with my blinding eye disease, I really started out on a quest to find help, a cure. And in 2008, in the April of 2008, I found myself down in San Francisco with a doctor who focuses on whole body health. And the first thing he said right out of the gate was, tell me about your childhood. And within minutes, I was sobbing. And he said two really powerful things to me. He said, do you realize that you're carrying this huge negative emotional energy charge inside of you over something that's happened so many years ago? And do you realize that you're still giving those circumstances and that former stepdad your power? And that shook me. But then he said something that really kicked me. He said, and if you think that that's not impacting your physical health, you're just crazy. And the idea that carrying this emotional trauma inside of me for so many years could be causing me to go blind was just this huge wake-up call for me. And I thought, you know, I've got to write this story. And I started writing it, and I really started understanding the healing power and validation that comes from writing your personal story. And again, I did not want to hurt anyone. I love my parents, and this all happened a very long time ago, and I know it's something that they would like to forget, but they've been supportive of me. And I started sharing my story through essays and through podcasts and started recognizing I would get feedback and realize that I wasn't alone, and that through personal storytelling, you can actually not only the healing power and the validation from being heard, but you can actually help others. And that's actually how I started in with the teen mentoring program. Right after, or even before, I published Hippie Boy myself, and I also did a small print-on-demand run, I wrote down a note that I wanted to use my story to help teens who were in similar circumstances. And I didn't know what form it would take, but a couple of weeks after, in late November 2011, I was contacted by an English teacher at a nearby alternative high school, and she said, this is the story I've been looking for my students. And you know what I heard was, will you partner for life? She, I think, meant for me to come in for a day. But the thing is, it was like being handed a huge gift. And starting in January 2012, we started using Hippie Boy as a guide to help her students find their voice and power by writing their personal stories. And then the power they found was so incredible that we helped them actually publish those stories as an ebook and print on demand. And now we've published two story collections for them. And the program keeps going, and now we've developed this Hippie Boy teaching guide to help educators everywhere empower students through personal storytelling. So the thing is, it was hard, and it's hard, but there's a lot of power that's come out of this, and so that's what I take out of it moving forward. It's sometimes people have to tell their stories.
And I've been reading some of those stories. Very powerful. We'll get into that a little later in the program,
okay.
Definitely. Break your heart, some of these stories, but very helpful as well. Let's jump into your story. We talked about a passage, but I wonder if you could just pull up the first, you know, the opening scene from the book, chapter one.
Sure.
I know,
give
you've
me
got a digital edition in front of you.
Give me a minute because
and,
my eyesight and everything else, it takes me.
I should set this up by saying that some of the chapters are labeled BE and AE, before Earl and after Earl. This is definitely, and it's definitely the voice of a teenage girl. Very powerful, unique voice. Some have talked about how this reads like a novel. It certainly does.
Thank you. I mean, my goal is to, I don't know, just tell the story from from my point of view at that time and write it as openly and as honestly as I could, and also just really try to capture what I was feeling from my perspective. I've got it. Do you want me to start right from the beginning, or should I go a little bit further when it gets...
Well, yeah, whatever you think is best. Just kind of the scene, the opening scene there.
Okay. I guess what I would like to read is... So my mother, so I'll give you a little background. Hippie Boy is a story, my story, about growing up in a home with kind of really, for me, extreme religion and poverty, but most of all, this oppressive Mormon stepfather who used religion as a weapon. And I'd always wanted to escape my life, and by the time my mom married him when I was just when I turned 13, I started escaping it by spending the summers on the road with my father. And my mom, my parents, you know, I'm glad they got together, but it was a rough go with them. And my dad wasn't really home when I was growing up. And when I was in sixth grade, they ended up getting divorced. And because my mom is very, very devout in her religious beliefs, she felt like she needed to get remarried. I mean, I know she was tired of doing it alone with five young children, but I think there was also the idea that she needed to be married in a temple with a priesthood holding husband. And so she rushed into this marriage. She met Tim in early December, and they decided to get married like 3 weeks later. And then 2 months after that, they did get married. So she had only known this guy for about 2 months when this occurred, and when she said that they were getting married, you know, she said this guy would not try to take the place of my dad in any way, and we all, you know, he was living out of the back of his mini camper. He was like homeless, really. He had been married at least a couple of times before, and you know, we just felt like he wasn't really who he was representing to be, as this devout Mormon. But anyway, they rushed into it. And so this is where I'll start it. So this is about 2 months after they knew each other. The first Friday in February, Dad dropped by for an unexpected visit. It was early evening, and as usual, Earl was hanging around, his grimy yellow home on wheels parked on the dirt strip in front of our house. I had told Dad all about Earl during his weekly phone calls, but my words clearly hadn't prepared him. The shock on his face when he walked in the door and took in Earl and his stench was so funny I had to bite my lip to keep from laughing. Earl stood next to Mom in the foyer, tightly gripping her hands on his grease-stained, stubby fingers. He had just come from the motorcycle shop where he worked and still wore his navy blue mechanic jumpsuit with the word Earl embroidered on the pockets. For what seemed like a minute, no one said a word. Then Dad jumped into action. "Well, hello," he said in a booming, playful voice. "I'm the ex. You must be my replacement. Hope you're better obeying than I was." Earl didn't speak. He just tightened his grip on Mom's hand. Mom glared at Dad, who grinned and shot her look that I interpreted as, "You traded me in for that?" "This is Earl," she said finally. Watching them interact reminded me of how Dad used to tease Mom by having her repeat the words 33rd Street, where they used to live, because it came out 33rd Street. But that was back when they still got along and laughed together. Mom and Earl quickly retreated to the kitchen with my two-year-old brother, Daniel. Jacob, Mom's obedient favorite, trailed behind them. That left Dad to visit with Connie, Heidi, and me in the living room. "Well, that was interesting," Dad said, shaking his head. "I don't know what's gotten into your mother, but then again, she always was a little cuckoo." "At least you don't have to hang around and smell him every day," I lamented. "He's disgusting." My sisters and I started telling Dad more about Earl and his fake Mormon act, but I noticed he wasn't listening. He kept fidgeting on the juice-stained green couch the church had donated to us and glanced repeatedly at the front door. Dad never could stay in one place for long because he couldn't stand being caged. He also had a short attention span for everything but work. He was obsessed with becoming a millionaire and was always on the lookout for a business opportunity that would finally make him rich. Well, he said, about 10 minutes into the visit, the real reason I stopped by is because I'm heading to Albuquerque, New Mexico for a week-long business trip. I'm wondering if any of you kids want to come with me. I felt like I had been just handed a get-out-of-jail-free card. I do, I yelled excitedly, throwing my arms around him for a hug. I'm going to skip down here a little bit to get to this part. After I jumped at the opportunity to go with Dad to New Mexico for the weekend, both Connie and Heidi quickly declined. Connie said she had to take care of Abby, the purebred Irish setter she had recently purchased with money she had saved from her maintenance job. Heidi, who was 10, said she had stuff to do. I was secretly glad they weren't coming. It meant I would have Dad to myself. Well, Ingrid, I guess it's just you and me, he said. We better get going. You better go tell your mom. I jumped off the couch and raced through our dirty, whitewashed hallway to the kitchen. I found Mom standing beside Earl next to our fold-out kitchen table. Mom, Dad invited me to go with him to New Mexico for the weekend. We need to leave in a few minutes. Is it okay? Can I go? My question was really just a formality. I couldn't imagine that Mom would have a problem with it. Though she had been granted sole custody of us by the court, she never prevented me or the other kids from spending time with Dad. She hesitated for a moment and then looked over at Earl. You'll have to ask Earl, she said. I felt the blood draining from my face. She actually wanted me to ask him for permission to go somewhere with my own dad. I shot Mom a pleading look, but she wouldn't return my gaze. She kept her eyes trained on Earl. I turned to face him, struggling to maintain my composure. Hot adrenaline was pumping through my body. I felt such an intense rage surging inside me that it was everything I could do to keep from punching him. Earl looked at me with his icy cold eyes. A small, mean smile crept across his face. I sucked in some air, trying to calm myself. Can I go to my dad with my dad in Mexico for the weekend, I seethed. Earl paused for a long minute, and I could see his mind churning. I don't know, he answered finally, gloating as he spoke. Your mother and I are going to have to pray about it. I stared incredulously at Earl, his smile widening. I turned to Mom. Mom, please, can I please go with Dad? He's waiting for me. I concentrated on keeping my voice calm, determined to hide the panic building inside me. She ignored my imploring looks and gazed at Earl. As a priesthood holder, an automatic right and power given to all worthy Mormon men, Earl was supposed to have a direct line of communication with God. Dad had been kicked out of the church, which meant his powers had been taken away. We're going to have to pray about it, she repeated. Then the two of them headed to her bedroom and closed the door. I ran back to the living room to report the situation to Dad, who was still sitting on the couch waiting. I was shaking and fighting to hold back the tears as I spoke. Dad looked as if he were ready to blow. What the hell does he have to do with it? Dad fumed, punching the couch with his fist. What in the hell is wrong with your mother? We both waited on the couch for Mom and Earl's answer. My stomach was churning. I couldn't believe this was actually happening. A few minutes later, I heard them come out of Mom's bedroom. I followed them down the hall to the kitchen to hear their answer. What about church? Earl asked smugly. You have to go to church. I glared at him, channeling all my hatred his way. He knew Dad had been excommunicated and wouldn't want to go. He also had to have realized there wouldn't be any time. Dad said Albuquerque was 550 miles away from Logan, our small, nearby northern Utah town. I ran into the living room. Dad, they say I have to go to church. Is there a way we can find a church in New Mexico? Dad's face turned purple. Tell them whatever the hell they want to hear, he barked. I headed back down to the hall to the kitchen. I felt smart and victorious. Dad says he will make sure that I attend at least one church meeting, I said, directing my comments to Mom. Earl didn't say anything for a minute. Mom stayed silent. Your mother and I will have to pray about it some more, he said finally. Then he grabbed her by the hand and led her back to the bedroom. I swallowed the screams making their way out my throat as I headed back to the living room to report the news to Dad. He didn't speak, but his hands were clenched into fists. I took my place next to him on the couch to wait. My stomach felt like 100 bees were buzzing inside it, angrily stinging me as I bumped up against their prison walls. My thoughts were racing so fast I couldn't focus on any of them. I could see my hands trembling, and I wanted to reach out and hold Dad's hand for support, but he looked too angry to touch. After what seemed like hours, Mom and Earl emerged from the bedroom a second time. Once again, I headed to the kitchen. Well, I asked, holding my breath. Ingrid, Earl said, a wide smile breaking open across his face. I'm sorry, but the answer is no. The Lord doesn't want you to go with your dad at this time. The emotions that had bottled up inside me came rushing out. "Mom, please let me go," I begged between sobs. "This is important to me. Please." She didn't say anything for a minute. She just stood silently next to Earl. "You heard what Earl said," she said finally, avoiding eye contact. "The answer is no." I turned to face Earl. "Earl, I want to go with my dad. He's my dad. I have a right to be with him." His eyes danced. It was clear he was savoring every moment. "I'm sorry, Ingrid. I really wish I could let you go. But like I told you, the Lord said no." Anyway, that was just kind of the opening that set the stage and really drew a line in our family. And I made a vow that night that no one would ever keep me from going with my dad again. And I would not let this man use religion to rule me.
Mm. We're talking with Ingrid Ricks. Her book is Hippie Boy, A Girl's Story, growing up in a poor and a devout Mormon home in Logan, and spending summers on the road with her traveling salesman father. It's a memoir. It's about religion and status, story of a small-town girl finding her independence and happiness as a woman on her own. We're going to take a brief break. We'll come back and talk more about this. Also get into talking about Ingrid Ricks' battle with the eye disease, retinitis pigmentosa, and her work mentoring teens through storytelling. WeAreAbsolutelyNotOkay.org is that website. Determined to See is her blog about her journey to heal her eyesight. And, of course, the book is Hippie Boy, now out in paperback. More following the break.
Utah Public Radio welcomes listeners in Price, where UPR can now be heard at 89.7 FM.
My name is Joe Peterson. I'm the chancellor at Utah State University Eastern. I want to say how delightful it is to turn on the radio and listen to UPR here in Carbon County. It's wonderful to have that in our community.
Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University's College of Humanities and Social Sciences and the Department of Journalism and Communication.
And programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread. At 300 South and 300 West in Logan, open Monday through Saturday until 3, offering lunch items including a three-cheese panini with a rosemary orange chutney and cranberry jalapeno chicken salad.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest today is Ingrid Ricks, who grew up in a devout Mormon home in Logan, Utah, and spent summers with her traveling salesman father, sleeping in trucks, selling merchandise on the side of the highway. Hippie Boy is a social commentary on religion and status, the story of a small-town girl along the road finding her independence and happiness as a woman on her own. She's also author of Focus, a memoir about her journey with the blinding eye disease, retinitis pigmentosa. And she's working on a memoir about a year-long quest to heal her eyesight. Blogging about her journey, you can read those entries at determinedtosee.com. And she mentors teens through storytelling. She found a release and power in telling her story. That website is weareabsolutelynotokay.org. More, of course, with Ingrid Ricks. And you can join this conversation. Hope that you will. If you have a question or comment, the way to do that, you can join our visit our Utah Public Radio Facebook page, where two people have liked our post. You can see a picture of Ingrid Ricks there. Ashley Halverson and Joseph Anderson have liked that post. You can comment there. You can call us at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. And you can join us by email to upraxis@gmail.com, upraxis@gmail.com. We do have this email from Steve. So let me read this and have Ingrid Ricks respond to this. He says, "Morning Edition ran a piece this morning about back pain and the medical community's increasing realization that the best way to overcome this affliction is not by invasive procedures or intrusive regimens, but rather by taking a holistic approach and by conquering it psychologically. According to the Morning Edition piece, this has been proving very effective. It sounds as though your guest is on a similar quest with her deteriorating eyesight. How is that going?" That's Steve's question. Ingrid Ricks, sounds like you are taking a holistic approach.
I am. So when I was on the road with my dad, my diet was so horrible, you know, sugar-free Dr. Pepper and hot dogs and Hostess cupcakes. And then on top of that, so that diet sort of stuck. And then on top of that, you know, I was carrying a lot of emotional stuff inside me. And at the beginning of this last year, it was really in February, I went to yet another retinal specialist who told me yet again that there was nothing that I could do to save my eyesight. And it just really got me riled up. And so I started on this eyesight healing quest. And I've been doing, I look at it whole body. It's emotional, it's spiritual, it's physical, it's diet, it's everything. So I've completely changed up my diet. Every morning now I do green juicing, kale, celery, cucumber. That's my morning standard juice. I do a lot of core body exercise. And I've really started in with acupuncture as well, acupuncture, acupressure, meditation. There's a guy named Dr. Rosenfarb in New Jersey who also focuses on whole body health, and he just did a study with Johns Hopkins University about the efficacy of treating my eye disease, retinitis pigmentosa, and macular degeneration, other diseases, but this one was focused on specifically my eye disease and showed that it can improve a little bit. So I've also been going out there. I started in December, and I noticed some improvement, and I'll be going out every 3 months. But for sure, I believe it. There's so many people out there who were told that there is nothing that they can do for their degenerative disease, whether it's eyes or eyesight or anything else. And I really am discovering that there's a lot that can be done with diet and lifestyle.
I wonder if you'd expand to something you said earlier, a connection, as you believe it, between emotional baggage that you're carrying and your health.
I believe there's a huge connection. In fact, I'm not sure if you've heard of, I think the acronym is ACE, Adverse Childhood Experiences. And the idea, I mean, I know there's a lot of studies that are starting to happen around this. The idea that if you as a child or adolescent carry around a lot of emotional trauma and you carry that into adults, they've looked at those kind of outside environmental factors, the epigenetics that trigger faulty genes and trigger degenerative eye disease or degenerative diseases in general. And I think it's huge, which is why part of the reason I'm so passionate about working with teens right now, because that's what we're finding. I mean, a lot of these teens that I work with have dealt with things that, you know, my story doesn't even hold a candle to, gang life, addiction, abuse, homelessness. But by getting their stories out, it's just changing their lives. But yeah, I'm a big believer in that.
Mm. Why don't you tell me a little bit more about this? I think it was 4 years or so with Earl, and he's using religion from your point of view, if not sincerely, but he's using this as a power, you know, a control.
Absolutely.
And I wonder how. And you said you didn't set out to write, you know, an anti-Mormon thing, but have you talked to other people in religion in general, and specifically in the Mormon religion, who have gone through these experiences as well?
Yeah, in fact, it surprised me. I always thought that I was alone. I mean, that's the other power of personal storytelling, is that you recognize that a lot of people have gone through similar experiences. In the May, I believe, of 2011, I was invited to share my story on a podcast called Mormon Expression. And I shared my story for about an hour, and afterward, probably 35 women got on that and said, this is my story, this is my experience, and started sharing similar stories of abuse of power. And again, I never set out to write anything negative about the Mormon religion. I have lots of friends and family who are wonderful, who are in that religion. But to say that abuse of power doesn't happen is just wrong. Abuse of power happens in every religion, and it certainly happens in the Mormon religion.
Mm. What has been the reaction? You've probably gotten pushback of people defending religion, defending Mormonism as they see it, and saying, you're not representing my experience.
Yeah, I mean, on Amazon, people have said things like, this author clearly should do research on the religion before she writes about something that she doesn't know anything about. Or they've said, if you want to know the truth, go to Mormon.org. And I think most people, where they'll just say, hey, I can tell by the description that this isn't a true story. And it surprised me, honestly, because it's just like, it's just my story. It's just my story, but I lived it, and it was a very painful story. But it is what it is. I've recognized that some people, no matter what, are going to have their beliefs. And it's just that I encourage open dialogue. You know, I think the more you talk about things and the more you make people aware of what can happen, you know, when someone is given absolute power, the more these things can be addressed so that they don't keep happening. You know, awareness, I think, is key.
Hmm. What about your view toward religion? Have you, through these experiences, have you become skeptical about religion, cynical?
I'm a spiritual person, but I... organized religion is not for me.
mm-hmm. Your mother has held, she's remained a devout Mormon, very much held to her beliefs through all of this, I believe.
Yes.
And I don't know how much you want to reveal, but I was relieved to you have a postscript where everybody is now.
Yeah.
And if she, I think, could you reveal, she did eventually divorce Earl.
She did. She eventually divorced Earl, and after a few years, married just a wonderful, wonderful man. And together, in fact, he was my mother is a convert to the Mormon religion, and he was as well. And he was absolutely wonderful. And together, they served once they were in retirement, three different Mormon missions. And yeah, so she found happiness. And you know, we've found kind of happiness together. I mean, recognizing that it's like we cannot see eye to eye. My dad and I even say this. It's like we may not see eye to eye, but we see heart to heart. And you know, we love each other, and we've struggled sometimes to like each other because our belief systems are so different. But I think we've come to a place where it's just like we can respect each other for who we are and look for the things that we have in common versus the things that we don't.
Mm. Reading some of these scenes was very uncomfortable for me. You take the person right there, and you just have a feeling of powerlessness. I mean, you definitely girls were feisty. Your elder, I think she's her older sister, Connie, would storm out and leave and try to stand up to Earl, and you certainly would as well. But there must have been a kind of a feeling you're in a kind of a small community. And I don't know what you can do. What would your advice be to people who are in such emotionally abusive or other abusive situations?
I would say speak up and tell people, and don't hide it. I mean, what I've discovered is that they're actually, when I really started kind of finding my voice and speaking out, people listened, and there are people who will listen. I mean, sometimes it does feel like you're completely alone and you're the only one going through this, and it is hard when you feel like everyone around you kind of is stomping out your voice. But just keep speaking out, keep searching for someone to talk to until you find that person who will listen and help you.
Mm. We're going to take another brief break, and when we come back, more with Ingrid Ricks, author of Hippie Boy, A Girl's Story. It was an e-book, a New York Times bestseller, and now it's out on paperback. And she's also author of Focus. It's a story of her battle with the eye disease, retinitis pigmentosa. She's writing a blog as well, DeterminedToSee.com. It's about her journey to restore her eyesight. And she recently co-founded a teen mentoring program through storytelling, weareabsolutelynotokay.org. We're going to talk a bit about those as well. We'll talk a bit about life on the road in the summertime with her larger-than-life father, more with Ingrid Ricks following the break.
When Sheryl Sandberg was a little girl, the other kids used to call her bossy. But then she did become the boss, number two at Facebook. And today, she asks audiences all the time,
please raise your hand if as a boy you were ever called bossy. No hands go up.
But when she asks women,
all the hands go up.
I'm Guy Raz. Lessons from Leaders, next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Coming up next this morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio. And programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Crim Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan, open Monday through Saturday until 3, offering Jewish rye, polenta cheese bread, and ciabatta sandwich buns.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams.
Growing up poor in a devout Mormon home in Logan, Utah was anything but ordinary for Ingrid Ricks. Spending summers on the road with her traveling salesman father, sleeping in trucks, selling merchandise on the side of the highway, was an escape from the strict rules of her mother and controlling stepfather. Hippie Boy is her memoir. It's a social commentary on religion and status, story of a small-town girl vying for the attention of her family and along the road finding her independence and happiness as a woman on her own. Ingrid Ricks is author of Focus. It's a memoir about her journey with the blinding eye disease, retinitis pigmentosa. There's also a blog you could check out, determinedtosee.com. That's her journey to find a cure to solve that problem. And she's recently co-founded WeAreAbsolutelyNotOkay.org. It's a program that empowers teens by helping them to write and publish their personal stories. Ingrid Ricks lives in Seattle with her husband and their two daughters. I wonder if you could tell us, Ingrid Ricks, about your father. He is a kind of a larger-than-life figure. He's very driven. And you go into his history, growing up in, I don't know if this is Utah or Idaho.
He grew up in Benson.
In Benson. So, and just very poor circumstances.
Yes.
And that lit a fire in him he didn't want to be poor anymore.
Exactly. So, and I didn't fully appreciate, my dad always, he was a dreamer, and he was always on a quest to make $1 million. And he couldn't stand rules, which is why he and my mother really struggled, and he didn't want to be confined. He didn't want to be employed by anyone else. And it wasn't until I started spending my summers on the road with him that I really began to understood what drove him. He would tell me stories about growing up in this little one-room shack with no heat or running water and an outhouse, and how his dad, they moved eventually into a bigger house, but his family eventually swelled to 11 children. He was the second oldest, the oldest boy. And at the age of 4, he would get up and start milking cows and making the round to feed the pigs and stuff. And his dad, my grandfather, would work all day on the farm, and then he would go to do a construction job in Ogden, I think, bust down and come back. And my dad would tell me, he's like, I would read these books on slavery and about how slaves were given just a little shack and some food. And I looked at my dad and thought, that's what he is. He's a slave. And my dad didn't want to be that. And he just made a vow that whatever it was, he was going to do something great with his life.
So you ended up spending summers out on the road with him. That must have been I guess, wonderful. It was an escape, for one thing.
It was incredible. He really was my lifeline. And the thing is, I mean, my friends didn't really understand it because they'd say 12 hours a day in this hot truck. But my dad and I were partners, and we had only two rules. And they were rules that I actually instigated because I wanted to do my part. It was like no eating breakfast until we'd sold $100 worth of tools, no quitting until we'd sold $500 worth of tools. And that was it. There were no other rules. So we would get up at 6 o'clock every morning, and we would both get a sugar-free Dr. Pepper, and we'd get in the old beat-up truck, and he would say, "What's our saying?" And we'd both yell out, "The early bird gets the worm." And then we would go out, and we would look for our prospects. And it was the early 80s, and the oil boom was in full swing. So our strategy was to drive the secondary roads of the Midwest looking for prospects. We would look for the lone gas station attendant or your do-it-yourself mechanic, but mostly our prospects were the migrant workers who worked. They would come up from Mexico working these oil rig sites, and my dad would say, "These guys have so much money in their pockets, they're just waiting for an opportunity to spend it while they're about to get their chance." So he would pull up into the oil rig site, and he'd look at me, and he'd say, "Okay, if I'm not back in 5 minutes, bring me a set of wrench sets." And so I would watch him, and he'd go out, and he'd say, "Is it hot enough for you today? Or I think it's quitting time, don't you?" And, if he could warm them up a little bit and enough time passed, I would come running out with my set of tools. And when guys saw that my dad had a daughter with him, it softened him up, and he would buy them, whether he needed them or not. And it was wonderful. I mean, usually we made our quota, which really meant about $150 net. Then by the time you spent all our road expenses and broken down trucks, it went really fast. But if we made enough money, we'd get a room at a Motel 6. And if we didn't, we would sleep in a rest area, and we ate at McDonald's, 7-Eleven, and Denny's every day. And to me, it was complete freedom. I loved it.
What was your perspective on your dad? Your dad was very serious, right, about making money. He wanted to become a millionaire or a successful business.
Absolutely.
Did you think he was going to make it?
And we would daydream about what life would be like when he made his $1 million. And he was going to buy a Cadillac, and I was going to buy kind of this fancy house in Logan, but it would be just for my sisters and myself, and we would live there so we could see our friends, but we wouldn't have to be, you know, with Earl. And we would dream, and he eventually did build a very successful telecom business, and then it crashed in 2000. And now he's at 74, he's going again. He's building a new network marketing business and doing really well. So he's just always been, I mean, what he taught me, two things. One, resilience. I know that if you put me down anywhere, I will survive. And he gave me that because of those years on the road. But he also taught me to dream. And he's been a huge supporter of my dreams and of doing whatever I want with my life. So he's been great in that way.
As I was reading, I was thinking to myself, please don't let this guy turn into Willie Loman. It was good to that would have been powerful, but I'm glad the reality was otherwise.
Right.
There's a motto you have on your website: by the mile it's a trial, by the yard it's hard, but by the inch it's a cinch. Where did you get that?
From my dad. He's got all sorts of these sayings that they may sound a little cliche, but they really do motivate me when I'm down. I mean, he's got, you know, that one. He also has one that says, you never know what you can accomplish as long as you keep on going. The minute you quit, you have your answer. And when we were driving down the road, he would point out a big tree and he'd say, you see that tree? You know, that tree didn't get there overnight. You know, it started as a seed, and it took water, and it took sun, and it took all these things. And he just really made me understand that if you want something, you know, it's up to you. I mean, even now, the thing about him is that you punch him and he's like one of those bouncing dolls, you know, he falls down and he springs right back up. And so I try to live by that as well. You know, it's like life sometimes can knock you down, but you just got to stand back up.
I wonder if you could tell us that there's a seminal moment, and this is in the publicity material, so I hope I'm not, you know, revealing too much here. Your dad gets arrested. It's an outstanding warrant from something in the past, and so it's a very important moment for you too.
That really was the moment that I found my voice. I recognized, I was out on the road with him. I was 16. We were in Illinois, and he got arrested, and I was told that they were probably going to extradite him to Texas, and that they would be putting me in foster care until I could figure out my way back to Utah. And I just, my summer had just started with my dad. I mean, I was a few weeks into it, and I lived for my summers with him, and there was just no way I was going to let him get taken away from me. But it was also, I'd always looked at him to save me, and in that moment, I realized that no one was going to save me but me. And so in that courtroom, when they said, well, it looks like we need to extradite him to Texas, and keep in mind, I had been sitting in a hot car all day. They had taken him away from me, and I didn't know what was going to happen. And they said they're extraditing him to Texas. And, all these years of no that were just bottled up inside me just came out in this one gut-wrenching scream no in that courtroom. And the judge listened. And that's the day that I found it. It's like, wow, you really speak out and someone will hear you. That judge cared. And as a result, he let my dad out on a bond.
Hmm. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about your program, Mentoring Teens. As I mentioned, I've been reading a few of those stories. Here's one. This is Jasmine Gifford, and her story is Believe. It's split up by hashtag, so it's BLIV. And she talks about a boyfriend who she came to know was controlling her. And she says, I would hope to get across that young girls need to have more self-respect. I don't know, and don't know how. We let guys control us because they know they can. There's all manner of stories here. Tell us a little bit more about mentoring teens with this program.
Well, it's really the most rewarding thing that's come out of any of this, the idea that because I wrote my story, these students are writing their stories. But, you know, we started, Margie Bowker and myself, the English teacher I partner with, we started in January 2012, and we mapped up this kind of ad hoc curriculum that for a month-long writing unit that would use Hippie Boy because it's so scene-based. We use it as a guide to help them kind of write their stories in a narrative format. And we ended that. It was only supposed to be this month-long program, but at the end of that month, we held an in-class reading, and these students were so charged up by reading their stories that we thought we just have to keep on going. And it has been, I mean, that first year, that book that you're talking about, we did, because I had just gone through the process, we held a week-long intensive publishing workshop at the school. They, because it's an alternative high school, they have twice a year these weeks where it's just one class and they do it. So we invited interested students, and 14 students participated, and they rewrote their stories. They came up with the title. They came up with the cover design. And it meant everything for them. The thing is that we didn't really understand how powerful it was until the book was out and they were on this local New Day Northwest morning show. The clip, if anyone wants to watch it, it is so powerful, and it's on the weareabsolutelynotokay.org website. But the students talked about how it transformed their lives and what it meant to them to finally be heard. And that night, we held a book reading. 400 people from the community lined up around the block to come in and meet them. And these kids, the second book's called You've Got It All Wrong, and on the cover, it's these labels that say, I am... Hi, my name is Druggie. Hi, my name is Loser. Hi, my name is Dropout. And these are names that these kids have been told and called repeatedly, often by adults who see them and judge them in a certain way. And what's happened is because these students write their stories and it gets out there, suddenly, instead of seeing them as these losers and these dropouts and these druggies, they go, wow, these kids are so resilient. They've gone through so much. And yet they're still pulling themselves up every day, and they're going to school, and they're trying to make their lives better. And it's been so life-changing and empowering for these students that, you know, we realize we just have to keep going. What's happening now is that high school students at different schools, I recently got contacted both by a student in Pennsylvania and one in Indiana who said, we want this program in our schools. They're initiating it. And to that, so Margie and I, because educators have also started saying, how can we get this in our school? The idea that you could make English so relevant and teach it to the Common Core, but really build a bridge to their life at home to really make school relevant. So we've come up with a Hippie Boy teaching guide that's also on the We Are Absolutely Not Okay website, but that that captures everything that we've done in class to help educators everywhere empower their students through personal storytelling. But I can't even tell you, these students, because I've got this eye disease, I struggle sometimes to read, and they've been coming to my readings up here. It's been incredible. And the first night, the light was dim, and I didn't appreciate it, and I couldn't read, and they stepped in and read for me. I mean, they've just become part of my family.
That's wonderful. Very powerful. We're out of time. We'll have to leave it there. Let's definitely give the websites the book we've been talking about most is Hippie Boy, A Girl's Story. That's her memoir, growing up in Logan, Utah. She has another book called Focus, a memoir about her journey with the eye disease retinitis pigmentosa, short story collection, a little Book of Mormon and Not-So-Mormon Stories. And she's working on a memoir about her year-long quest to heal her eyesight. She's blogging about that journey at DeterminedToSee.com. And the website for the program that empowers teens by helping them to write and publish their personal stories is weareabsolutelynotokay.org. Ingrid Ricks, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
By the way, the website, if you want to get to go to her website, is ingridricks.com. And coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk more folklore. Last week we talked folklore. This book's called Latter-day Lore, Mormon Folklore Studies. Eric Eliason, Tom Mould, my guests. Please join me tomorrow. That's Access Utah. And for producers Katie Swain and Bennett Purser, I'm Tom Williams. Thanks so much for listening today.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
Imagine yourself living in Utah hundreds of years ago, before cars, before horses, before European influences. Summers provide you with abundant game and a multitude of plants for food and other materials. But the winters are harsh and full of snow. How did Native Americans manage to survive winter without modern amenities like snowplows and grocery stores? These hardy individuals owe their ability to hunt and travel in our snowy climate to one important tool, the snowshoe. Snowshoes have been a part of life for humans in cold weather climates for at least 6,000 years. From what historians can tell, people living in Central Asia learned to strap thin planks of wood to their feet in order to help them travel through deep snow. Snowshoes work by increasing the surface area of the wearer's foot, which distributes his or her weight across more snow, allowing them to basically float on top of the snow. From this common ancestor in Central Asia, both snowshoes and skis arose. Over the years, people began to spread out and move to new locations. Those who went west into Europe eventually developed the ski, and those who went east, across Siberia and into the Americas, developed the snowshoe. The early snowshoes used by Native Americans were constructed of a wooden frame which was laced with babiche, an untanned animal hide. While we will likely never know why that first person decided to strap a plank of wood to their foot, perhaps they took their cue from Mother Nature. You see, humans are not the only ones who have figured out how to keep themselves afloat on snow. Some members of the animal world have too, and Utah holds two standout examples, the aptly named snowshoe hare and the Canada lynx. Both of these animals have extraordinarily large feet, which act much the same as our snowshoes, distributing the animal's weight across a larger surface area. Perhaps it's no coincidence that both snowshoe hares and Canada lynx share this amazing adaptation. These two species are closely connected to each other in a special relationship, that of predator and prey. Leaving us to ponder the question, whose snowshoes came first, the lynx or the hare? For more information and photos of traditional snowshoes, please visit our website at www.wildaboututah.org. Thank you to the Rocky Mountain Power Foundation for supporting the research and development of this Wild About Utah topic. For the Stokes Nature Center and Wild About Utah, this is Andrea Liberator.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.